Welcome to the Azure Security Podcast, where we discuss topics relating to security, privacy, reliability, and compliance on the Microsoft Cloud Platform.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 93. This week it's myself, Michael, with Mark and Sarah. And this week we have two guests. We have Tony Rice and we have David Ornstein, who are here to talk to us about the Continuous Microsoft Security Development Lifecycle, or the Continuous SDL. But before we get to our guests, let's take a little lap around the news. Mark, why don't you kick things off?
Yeah, so for my news. Couple things coming up for me. Tampa B-Sides going to be presenting at the main show on Saturday. And so I'm going to be talking about, I think we called it the No BS SOC, but some real straightforward truths around security operations and how it works and what good looks like and how they actually grow from, you know, a couple part-time people or one part-time person into a global kind of 24/7 operation. And I'm also doing some training, which is still available, some slots there, on the Friday before, talking about a security adoption framework for Microsoft. So, you know, essentially, how are we guiding customers on the overall security modernization piece and kind of talking through how we guide that and some of the lessons learned, best practices there. So that's a two-hour session on the Friday from, I think, 3 to 5. And then I'm also talking at RSA. So for folks that are going to be in that area, love to meet you face-to-face. Got a couple of theater sessions in on the show floor, and then a main conference session. It's actually going to be a really fun one. It's called You're Doing It Wrong, Common Security Anti-Patterns. So we're really kind of zooming in on all the things that we see organizations kind of get wrong, often, you know, for all the right reasons and without really knowing that. But, you know, making sure we're calling out hey, these are the opposite of best practices. These are the things you need to fix. And then, you know, how to address those with best practices. And we've got some interesting themes and whatnot that we're going to do there and reveal some interesting new content there as well. So that's the news for me.
So I just have one bit of news this time, which is that Trusted Launch is now in preview for AKS. So essentially, that means that the Trusted Launch is improving the security of AKS nodes from persistent attack techniques. So it means that we're going to have the machines underneath have bootloaders that are verified and signed, and also same for the OS kernels and the drivers. So of course, you're trying to have an entire boot chain that has been all secured. So you should go and have a look at that because, of course, we love all of our boot chain being nice and secure. So go and have a play around with that if you're using AKS. And that's it from me.
I actually have quite a bit of news this week, but I'll try and keep it brief. The first one is there's been a huge improvement in Azure Key Vault. In fact, I was talking to a customer this week who said that they couldn't use Key Vault. They had to use managed HSM instead because they have a requirement for FIPS 140-2 level 3 hardware. Well, guess what? Azure Key Vault now supports FIPS 140-2 level 3 if you're using the hardware SKU, like there's two variants you can have. And if you use the non-standard SKU, that one includes support for FIPS 140-2 level 3 HSMs, which is absolutely fantastic. All you have to do is create new versions of keys, and they will roll over to the new hardware. There's also something which actually blew me away when I saw this, because I did not know this was coming out, and that is that the Microsoft Intune suite now supports the Microsoft Cloud PKI, which basically means that you can set up your own, essentially a certificate service, to issue your own certificates for your own devices and your own services and so on. This is really magnificent to see. So I've got a couple of posts on that information, because this is really, really cool, because it means that you can now start, again, issuing your own certificates for your own use as opposed to using a third party. The next one is, so Merrill Fernando, who is a product manager over in Entra ID, has a video called Run a Quick OAuth App Audit of Your Tenants Using This Command and Protect Yourself. So basically what it is a tool that he's added to his MS Identity Toolkit, and it's a PowerShell commandlet that will dump all the app IDs that you're using inside of your tenant, so they can see if they're You know, are they being used? Are they old? Do they need revoking? You know, what? Because a lot of people don't have a lot of visibility into their applications that are running with managed identities. So a big hat tip to Merrill for doing this. Next one is, actually, I'm very proud of this. This is actually the first feature I've shipped in a Microsoft product in a long time, very, very long time. And that is, we now have support for iterated and salted hash password verifiers in SQL Server 2022, cumulative update 12. So historically, we stored a password verifier using SHA-512, which is okay. There's no vulnerability there, but some compliance programs require something even more secure, which is to perform iterations over that, again, slowing the attacker down. So we've now added that support. It's hidden behind a trace flag, so it's not enabled by default. You must go and enable it, but basically it's there for compliance purposes. And yeah, it's really good to see that being added. We started the work late last year, and this is driven primarily by customer requirements. Next one is, you know, unless you've been living under a rock recently, there's been a big discussion about using Rust versus, say, C and C++ for systems development, or more accurately, using memory-safe languages. And there's a document came out from the government explaining the benefits of using memory-safe languages, and Rust was called out as an example in there. Well, then there's a salvo came from the other side, which is from Bjarne Strustrup and Herb Sutter. So Herb works at Microsoft, and he's actually on the C++ ISO standardization committee. And he put out a post which is worth the read. And it's basically that the White House document ignores all the changes that have been made in modern C++ over the last, I don't know, half dozen years or so. So it's well worth looking at these. Don't get me wrong, I'm actually wearing a Rust t-shirt right now. I'm a huge fan of Rust. I really, really am. But modern C++ is also still worth a look. It's not your father's C++ anymore. Unfortunately, a lot of C++ code is still written as essentially a glorified C, where you're dealing with pointers directly and buffers directly and so on and so forth. Whereas modern C++ abstracts that all away with almost zero performance degradation. So it's worth reading, especially if you're involved in that space. Next one, which is my last one, is that Microsoft Entra ID logins is now supported in Azure SQL Database if they have non-unique display names. Historically, you had to have a unique display name, which isn't always the case. It's quite possible you may have two, I don't know, John Smiths. Now you can actually create a login in Azure SQL Database using create login from external provider with object ID. And you can actually put in the GUID for the user as opposed to their name. So that way you get rid of this, essentially this name collision. So that's good to see as well. Always great to see these kinds of advancements being made in our database platforms. All right, that is my news out of the way. So let's turn our attention to our guests. This week, as I mentioned, we have two guests. We have Tony and David, who are here to talk to us about Continuous SDL. So gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. We'd like to take a moment and introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, everyone. Michael, Mark, nice to chat with you again. It's great to meet you, Sarah. My name is Tony Rice. I've been with Microsoft for 25 years. Yes, it's been that long. I've known Michael for a good fair few of them. I'm currently in the Digital Security and Resilience Organization. I'm responsible for Microsoft security policy all up, including the SDL. In my career throughout Microsoft, I've held various roles, including working in the field as a security consultant, and more recently working with the engineering groups, helping them implement the security development lifecycle. And that's where I first discovered that it actually needed to be updated. And so one of the things that we've been working on is something called Continuous SDL.
Hey, everybody. My name is David Ornstein. I'm an engineering manager in Microsoft. I work in the Digital Security and Resilience Organization with Tony. We're peers in the company. I've been at Microsoft for 24 years, just sort of chasing Tony's tail along there all a good amount of the time there. I'm a software engineer, more than a security expert, but for the last 15 years or so, I've been working in the security space, helping run the Trustworthy Computing Initiative for quite some time. And then for the last 10 years or so, building tools and systems that are underneath our implementations of running the SDL at scale in the company.
So I'll kick it off with, I've got gray hair, what little bit of it is left. So I remember the original SDL and when it kind of got rolled out. But, you know, for our audience, you know, can you just give us a kind of an overview of kind of the SDL, what it is, what the purpose is, and you know, kind of how people should be using it?
So what is the SDL? It's a great question. So the SDL is a process that was invented a long time ago. We'd be interviewed by Mr. Howard, one of the grandfathers of SDL. But its main aim is to help engineers build secure software by helping everyone find security issues as early as possible in the life cycle, removing them, or if we can't remove them, reducing the severity of those issues. What we found as we've been progressing over the years is that it's really, really hard to do things in the ways that we used to. We used to have a final security review. We used to run tools occasionally, but now we run them all the time, always. And this is where the foundation of continuous SDL comes in. So we're using the data-driven approach to continuously evaluate everything that happens within both the engineering pipeline and the source code. And we use that to make decisions for the benefits of security on a daily basis.
You know, it's funny. First of all, I'm not sure whether to be thankful or what about being referred to as the grandfather of SDL. I'm not sure if I'm being called old there or not. But anyway, it's interesting though, because, you know, if you look at the book that Steve Lipner and I wrote called The Microsoft Security Development Lifecycle, I still think it's a useful book. It's a good book, but there's a lot missing. And to your point, David, one word that's missing in there is cloud. I mean, there is nothing about cloud. We touch on pipelines a little bit, but certainly there is nothing about cloud scale, cloud deployment, you know, this constant, continuous delivery of software. And to your point, I mean, the SDL needs updating just because of that alone, you know, just, you know, as more practices become more agile. Is that a fair comment?
I think you can think about it as two primary drivers, one internal and one external. The internal one is just the nature of building software and the kinds of things that we're building and how we're doing it has just changed radically. You know, the SDL has been pretty much continuously changing for all of this time. Continuous SDL is just a name for the latest sort of wave of changes. But if you look at the SDL originally was, you know, we were releasing products every 2 or 3 years or something like that. And the way you can think about tackling security when you're doing that is just completely different than if you're building large complex services where you're releasing them on a practically a continuous basis, you know, every day, maybe multiple times a day. You just have to tackle things differently. And I think that's sort of the internal side. And then I would say the external side is just the nature of the threat landscape and the attackers and the way they are functioning is, you know, unless you're asleep, unless you're not paying any attention, you understand that the world is just under some pretty serious threat, and we are, and our customers are. And so a lot of what we're doing right now is responding to that. And the changes for continuous SDL have been underway for a couple of years, but are really being accelerated as part of a broader initiative, which is Microsoft's response to a lot of what's going on in the outside world, called the Secure Future Initiative, which includes continuous SDL, but includes a range of other things.
By continuous evaluation, I assume you mean essentially tooling, right? So static analysis and potentially dynamic analysis. Can you give some examples of what that might look like, and perhaps even what customers, you know, people listening to this could potentially use as well?
Okay, well, I'm happy to start with the continuous evaluation component, because that's where we were. So the number of things that you want to make sure are true about a piece of software, you know, has grown substantially. You know, we used to want to make sure there were no buffer overruns, and now there's 10,000 things we want to make sure are true. Because as the threat landscape has changed and as the attackers have gotten smarter, there are just more and more ways that they can get in and more ways for us to keep them out. And so, you know, if you think about how long does it take to go sort of take one pass over a fairly large complex piece of software and figure out whether you're actually, you know, meeting all of those requirements in the SDL. That's a pretty substantial process. And, you know, it originally, you know, because we only released, as I said earlier, we only released, let's just say infrequently, you know, before the world of cloud, you could, you know, take some time during the tail end of the development cycle of a piece of software and sort of have your security push and have your security focus and do your evaluation. And that's just not feasible anymore, because if you wait for that, what you find is just an enormous pile of stuff to do at the end. And in fact, if you find the problems late, they're way more expensive to fix than if you can find them early. So the first major part of continuous SDL is continuous evaluation. And what that's about is using data. We'll talk more about the data stuff in a little bit, but that's about basically doing as much evaluation as you can throughout the entire lifecycle, the design process, code, build, deployment and test environments, all of that kind of stuff, and being able to examine the security state relative to all of the different things that we're trying to control and manage in SDL, examining that security state on a continuous basis, and then being able to take action really as early as possible. You know, some people call it a shift left, catching things upstream. It really makes it possible to fix things as early as possible, and makes it really feasible to catch them all, or hopefully all.
All right, so let's get stuck into some of the guts of this thing. So what are the core elements of continuous SDL? If each of you wants to take one topic and just run with it.
Sure. Well, I mean, some of the most obvious ones are automated tools that look at code. So static analysis and dynamic analysis tools. One of the CodeQL tool, which I think we'll probably talk about a little bit more when we get a little bit later on, that's available to Microsoft customers. We run internally, and we've been broadly deploying. And that's a great tool for doing really sophisticated analysis of the code. But, you know, the kinds of security vulnerabilities that exist in the systems that we're building today go way beyond just the kinds of things that you can find with a static analysis tool by looking at just at the code. Things that involve, let's say the use of secrets, being able to find all the places where you're using secrets and the methods of authentication that you're using and where and how you're managing those secrets and, you know, making sure that you don't have loose secrets in code or loose secrets in text files in your repositories. And, you know, there are a range of tools, some of which we have available in our commercial products like Azure DevOps and GitHub. And Azure, in fact, a lot of the automatic scanning stuff that we're talking about that we use internally is available for our customers there. And so we sort of monitor the status of all of those things. Plus, we have a range of things that are, you know, more specific to the kind of products and services or maybe the engineering infrastructure and tools and systems that we use internally where we run automation. So you can imagine a system that wakes up, you know, every day or a couple of times a day and sort of looks left to right across all the telemetry and the exhaust out of all of the different systems that are sort of part of the engineering environment where we are building, testing, and operating the services, and then, you know, applies a set of digital rules to that stuff in order to figure out, you know, understand as much as possible the sort of the true security state of the software.
Okay, so gents, I'm going to ask, maybe because I'm the noob of the people on here, about SDL. Of course, I know what it is, but I'm definitely not a grandfather of SDL. Sorry, Michael. But why are we updating the SDL now? Because, of course, it's been around for a long time. But what's driving the update right now? Is there any particular reason?
So I think that's one of the big innovations that we've made, if it's, you know, if we can claim it as an innovation. No, so there's similar to what we see outside from regulators and governments and the cyber EO, you know, there's more and more organizations and asking for transparency. Transparency into what you do, transparency into the tools you use, transparency into the things that you find. But similarly, we see the same requests inside. It's just through a different pivot, through a different eye. So if we are going to run a tool and we're going to find issues and ask an engineer to do a repair, if necessary, they want to know why. They want to know what tool was run, when it was run, what particular issues was found, why was it important. And so pulling all this information together and being able to say, on this day, this tool was run, these issues were found, or none of these issues were found, but all these rules were tried, is a really, really great way to actually bridge the gap internally for transparency, you know, letting the engineer know why we're asking them to do work. But also, conversely, when we work with auditors and other regulators, say, hey, look, no, we ran this tool on this day at this moment in time with all these rules, and we found nothing. And that's a great way to, you know, to build a traceable evidence path, but also provide transparency into our processes. And this is going to be, you know, ever so important as we move forward. You talked about the scale and the speed of deployment in the cloud. How can, you know, any audit that you do in that environment is a point in time. It was old the minute you've completed it. And so being able to provide this level of evidence will really go a long way. There's no way that the, you know, I think you mentioned one of our dear friends before, Mike, Steve Limper would say, no, the industrial complex for audit and review, there's no way that they can keep up with this. No, there's no way that that a physical audit at a point in time is valid for other than that point in time. But what we're building here is a way to be able to, you know, measure things more immediately, take action more immediately. And I think it's the way for future compliance.
So you bring up an interesting point there about transparent and sort of traceable evidence. And what does that look like? I mean, and, you know, what could customers do as well? I mean, if let's say, you know, there's a requirement to run static analysis tools to find specific kinds of vulnerabilities. I mean, what do you provide that, you know, shows that you did this and these issues were found and these issues were rectified? I mean, what does that kind of look like?
In our system, and so David's the engineer here, and so he's built a wonderful system. What that looks like, if we pick on, say, CodeQL, so across Microsoft, there's thousands of products used and tens of thousands of repositories with different languages in each repository. The way that we've implemented CodeQL is that we capture all that information, all the scanning information centrally, and therefore we can measure, was a particular language in a particular repo scanned? And we also have the catalog of rules that were scanned for. And so from a external perspective, we know that at this point in time, all the languages in this, and we put this together in a package, and maybe David could speak more to this. So we can, so I, for instance, I know that 10 repositories of certain language types was scanned on this day using this rule set, and nothing was found. So that's really good for outside. Inside, you know, inside of Microsoft, if an issue is found, it's the same sort of deal. We know the evidence that gets provided to an engineer in that case would just be the issue that gets found. They would be given actionable information, including potential how to fix, the guidance that we have, and David's working on some innovation around here, is, you know, to lead an engineer down the right path to do things and to do things immediately. You know, the more we can give them, the more precise we can give them, you know, we'll actually go in our solution, takes them straight down to the line of code that needs to be fixed, you know, and suggest a fix. And in this case, we've captured the fact that there was an issue. The solution that we built for CodeQL, the issue remains with the code until we get a new update, a new scan that the code has been fixed, and therefore the issue goes away. The new evidence pointer doesn't include the issue. And that's a real benefit for anybody in security assurance, because the issue travels with the code or ideally the code gets fixed and the issue doesn't travel with it. All too often in old school SDL, an issue would be tracked as a security bug. It becomes disconnected from the code, and trying to keep all those things in sync in a world of fastly moving software development is nigh on impossible. And so I think the way that we capture that information now, and the way that the information, or rather the way that a issue that's been discovered only goes away once it's been repaired, is a big step forward.
I think the short version of my answer to your question, Michael, is you actually have to design keeping the evidence in a connected way. You have to design that into your system on purpose. So obviously inside of Microsoft, we use a lot of the same tools and systems that are used outside by a lot of our customers. But we also have special stuff inside, just like everybody does in their, how they've set their own things up and custom tools and stuff. And, you know, the systems that Tony is talking about, like the reason that we have this transparent and traceable evidence element of continuous SDL is because it's literally designed in. So starting right with the SDL, the SDL is comprised of a set of requirements. Those requirements have identities. When we perform the data-driven evaluation to figure out whether a particular product or service is meeting each of those requirements, we record a record that says, this product or service, you know, with this identity met this requirement or didn't meet this requirement. And then there's a list of evidence pointers, and all of that's in a data structure that is stored and persisted on purpose. And those pointers to the related evidence point possibly to other claims of conformance or non-conformance. And I mean, you literally have to just design a system that's going to keep track of all of that data. So it's built in, but not by accident, you know? So, I mean, the broadly speaking, you know, I think that what I would say is, keep that evidence, right? You know, if you're a customer building systems and you want to have confidence that they're secure, you know, just like everybody understands, you know, and sometimes when you discover something's wrong, you want to be able to go back and look and figure out what happened in the past. You know, that's the same reason we all keep audit logs around and stuff like that. Keep that evidence around so that you can go back and look at it. Now we've made a lot of progress and pretty excited about sort of systematically kind of in a heterogeneous way being able to glue all that stuff together, but the core idea is you got to keep it and you got to know where it is.
On the next topic, so you mentioned before, David, about data-driven methodologies, and wanted to give us some kind of insight into what that means.
You know, if you think about how most, let's just say broadly speaking, auditing and compliance work happens, somebody says, okay, well, you know, the standard says you have to do these 10 things, and then an auditor comes in and they've got a clipboard with a little checklist of 10 things, and they want to know whether those 10 things got done. So they go ask some people and they say, you know, did these 10 things get done? And somewhere, you know, ideally you would, you know, find a document that's a record of those 10 things being done. So, you know, that's a sort of a broad concept. And, you know, for the SDL, a large portion of our original methodologies were based on what we often call manual attestation, which is for you go ask a developer on the team, hey, for example, you know, are you using a particular, you know, deprecated form of encryption that we no longer think is a good idea to use? And, you know, our SDL compliance program at scale across the company would rely on that engineer answering that question correctly. Think of it as manual attestation. The challenge is that, you know, the landscape of things that you need to know about your systems now has become so large that actually it's really not a reliable way for people to do that. You know, the code, I don't remember how the code I wrote 3 years ago works. I can barely remember how the code I wrote six months ago works. You know, and so the truth comes from data. The truth comes from looking at logs. The truth comes from looking at the code. The truth comes from looking at, you know, databases that are, you know, records of things that actually happened. And so that's really what this data-driven methodology is about taking all the SDL requirements and moving as much as we can away from anything that's based on manual attestation to actually evaluating data that we know tells the truth. You know, if you want to know, you know, whether every server in a data center associated with a particular service is keeping up with patching, you know, you don't want to ask a human being that, even if they're responsible for making sure that that happens, because people can make mistakes. This landscape is very complicated. But if you interrogate the scan logs from all of those servers, you will know the truth. So the data-driven thing is really all about having the evaluation process, the compliance engine at the middle of all of this stuff that's doing the continuous evaluation we were talking about earlier, using as much as possible, using data triggers, looking at the issues that are found during static analysis with CodeQL, looking at you know, configuration of people's Azure DevOps instances to figure out whether, yes, actually every repository is configured to require two full-time employees to sign off on every pull request. You know, so each of these things, you can look at the data and find out the truth. And that's what the data-driven methodology piece is about.
And I suppose it just gives you better insights into whether you're making progress or not, right? I mean, if the numbers are going up, that's probably not good. But if the numbers are going down, then perhaps that's a good thing. Perhaps we're making progress.
Yeah, well, I like to see the numbers go down to zero. But of course, sometimes you need a glide slope to get there. You know, I think the other thing is that, you know, going back to the point about evidence and transparency, you know, if I have a piece of evidence that I've recorded that the reason that we decided that somebody had didn't have any of a certain kind of vulnerability was because somebody said they didn't, you know, that's evidence, but it's not very strong evidence. Whereas if I can say, well, here were the static analysis rules that we ran with CodeQL against the source code, and it was this version of the commits in this repository, and like that really detailed, like you know what actually happened, you know, that's stronger evidence. And so increasingly this being data driven, it enables, you know, these different pieces are all sort of tied together. This enables the transparent evidence collection and organization as well.
I think if I was going to add one additional thing, perhaps would just be that it enables us also to see where we can still make improvements. You know, so to your point, it might go up. You introduce a new tool, you introduce a new rule, you get to immediately see that across the entirety of the estate because we're taking a data driven approach, and it's there, and so we can immediately tell from our implementation, know what the cost is to Microsoft, what the cost is to an individual engineering group, and help them come up with a plan to address the issues, if there indeed are issues, if we bring a new rule in. You know, we, from time to time, we have a incident, you know, and in some cases, it was maybe because we didn't have a correct rule, or it might even be a new attack pattern that we're not aware of. And so when we add that to our tooling, whether that's CodeQL or another tool, you know, the fact that we can take a broad data-driven view across the entirety of the Microsoft estate and see what the impact that has before we take action is a benefit to everyone.
And that's an important point, right? The fact that this is continuous is, as we see new vulnerability classes or new, you know, variants of existing vulnerability classes, we can adapt quickly, right? We're not like we're waiting 2 years to update some tools or some education or whatever, right? This whole thing is designed to be updated rapidly as new threats evolve.
It was always the case that, you know, the SDL team were tightly connected to the MSRC team for, you know, the Microsoft Security Response Center team for learning about new variants of issues. But now we're even more tightly integrated with those things. And from a, you know, the tool that's closest to my heart is the CodeQL tool. We can literally have a new rule in place and scan it, you know, for a new incident and a new variant. We can have a new CodeQL rule in place in the afternoon, say if we find something in the morning, and we can have scanned all of Microsoft by the following day and have the results. It's pretty impressive feedback loop in terms of just how fast we can respond these days.
See, on the CodeQL topic, and I really don't want to spend too much time on CodeQL right now, but one of the things I love about CodeQL is the fact that it is, in the overall scheme of things, relatively easy to write new rules. That just blows me away. In fact, I don't even go as far as to say it democratizes writing rules, because you don't need to go to some person who, you know, will quite happily relieve you of $100,000 to write some new rule for a, you know, some bespoke static analysis tool, right? This is something that you can do yourself if you're using CodeQL. I'm not saying that it is really, really easy, but it's certainly a heck of a lot easier than writing your own compiler in the first place. I've written CodeQL rules. I'm not going to say they're awesome, But, you know, there's things that I've seen, and I've written simple CodeQL queries to help me narrow down where vulnerabilities may exist. So I'm a huge fan of CodeQL, and I think we should at some point get someone probably from the CodeQL team on the podcast to really go through it in detail, because this isn't a tool that's just Microsoft only, right? This is available on GitHub, and you can run it on repos that you own. Yeah, this is a really great tool. Which kind of is a nice segue, actually, into the next section, which is modernized practices. David, you want to give us the lowdown on modernized practices?
Actually, I'm going to let Tony take that one because it's much more in his area.
It struck me, you know, Sarah's question at the very start was, you know, why are you just updating the SDL now? And the answer is, it's not just now. You know, we've been updating the SDL for the longest time. It gets updated all the time. We've just been talking about how incidents, you know, new classes of issues, variants of issues, how they affect requirements and tooling. So we're updating our things all the time. You know, it's the requirements that we have are constantly being updated. But we see things happening in the ecosystem at large. And so if anyone's taking time to read the white paper, they'll know that we updated six requirements last year. We added six requirements last year. So what was all that about? And so some of it was around issues that we just needed to pull out that were already embedded within a requirement, but you wanted to pull it out to bring it into focus for the rest, for all of Microsoft, so we can, you know, really focus just in on one issue. But the other issues are around engineering system. You know, so we've seen over the years and recently that, you know, adversaries also don't just go after the code, they go after the infrastructure the code is built on. And so we spent a lot of time looking at like what we could do in the environment to help improve the security of the systems that we engineer on. And so that was one of the things that we've done. It's the SDL now is all encompassing. It's the software that gets created. It's the operational environment that the software is released into. And it's also the engineering systems that the software is built from. But we've also constantly looking at what's happening in terms of Microsoft, where the innovation is going, what we need to do. And of course, AI is on the tip of everyone's tongue right now. And so we're deeply embedded. People on my team are embedded in the AI group, the artificial generative intelligence and security team inside of Microsoft. And so there's a team that's being pulled together looking at all the potential threats that come along and vulnerabilities that come along with AI, learning about them together as a group and bringing that back into the SDL. And so we've made updates, both in terms of how we pen test, how we, you know, go about looking, finding proactively vulnerabilities in new innovation around there, but also things such as threat modeling. You know, how do you effectively threat model AI systems? So we continually look across everything that we do and always think about how we can improve all our requirements based on what's changing.
Okay, gents, so I know that you've been prepped for this, but something that we always ask our guests at the end of the podcast episode is for your final thought, something that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Well, I'll just toss in, this is David, I'll toss in my thought, which is really in some ways just a recapitulation of what we talked about earlier, which is that the nature of building software is changing internally and the threats are constantly changing around us. And the four areas in continuous SDL that we're driving at Microsoft, the continuous evaluation part being data-driven, you know, having evidence and transparency and continually modernizing practices, those are absolutely essential for us. And I think pretty much, you know, no company and no set of software really lives as an island anymore. And so all of our customers and all of our partners around the world who are building systems to some degree or another have to actually be thinking about all these things. So some of these lessons about continuous stuff, data driven and so forth, I would recommend you internalize. You can read more about the stuff that we talked about here today. I think the white paper that we've been chatting about today is linked in the podcast webpage.
All right, so let's bring this episode to an end. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this week. It's just fantastic seeing SDL, you know, alive and kicking and being updated, especially in light of the new threat landscape, new development tools, new attack techniques, new everything, right? So it's really good to see. So again, thank you so much for joining us. And to all our listeners out there, we hope you found this episode of use. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.